Hey, it's Mark. Just wanted to let you know that early bird tickets for the next Crosscut Festival are on sale now. Remember, the festival is happening May 1st and 2nd, 2020. If you want to go, head to crosscut.com/festival and enter the code CROSSCUT to save 15%. Hope to see you there. Okay, on with the show. Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. Women's professional sports have seen a surge in popularity in recent years, with more awareness, more fans, and more ticket sales. The U.S. women's soccer team's victory in the World Cup this past summer was an especially big reminder that women's athletics can have just as much cultural value and commercial viability as men's. But the playing field is far from level. To this day, female athletes earn a fraction of what their male counterparts do. They receive far fewer corporate sponsorships, and their teams have far fewer resources. Few women are coaches, executives, or athletic directors. And just an estimated 3 or 4% of sports media coverage is of women's sports. Crosscut invited a panel of female athletes and executives from the Seattle area to discuss these persistent inequities and to chart how far we've come and how far we have to go. Jamie Redd is a former member of the Seattle Storm, the WNBA team that has taken home 3 championships, making it Seattle's most successful sports team. She has also worked as an assistant basketball coach at Pacific Lutheran University and was named to the Pac-12 Women's Basketball All-Century Team in 2016. Amy Griffin has been the associate head coach of the women's soccer team at the University of Washington for 24 seasons. A 1991 World Cup champion, she was also a 2018 U.S. Youth Soccer Hall of Fame inductee and the recipient of many other national awards, including the Assistant Coach of the Year Award from the National Soccer Coaches Association of America. Teresa Predmore is co-owner of Rain FC, a professional soccer team based in Tacoma, Washington. A former member of the women's soccer team at Oregon State University, she is also owner of the Rain Academy, which operates soccer programs for female players ages 9 to 19. Ginny Gilder is co-owner of the Seattle Storm with Force 10 Hoops, the group that purchased the team in 2008. A longtime entrepreneur, investor, and social justice advocate, she was also a member of the women's rowing team at Yale University, and went on to row for 4 national rowing teams and win 2 international medals. Samantha Allen is an author, a Crosscut contributor, and a Seattle Storm season ticket holder. She moderated the discussion. In the first part of this episode, you'll hear the athletes' and coaches' perspectives from Jamie Redd and Amy Griffin. In part two, they'll be joined by our guests on the business side of sports, team owners Ginny Gilder and Teresa Predmore. This conversation was recorded on September 26, 2019, as part of the Crosscut Talks Live series.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited to see you all, and welcome to Equal Play, Will Women's Sports Ever Get a Fair Shake? I'm really thrilled to be moderating the discussion tonight and to introduce our panelists today. As Mark said, we're going to do the conversation in kind of two waves. And we're here to talk about the state of women's sports at the professional and the collegiate level with a strong local focus. I want to note, first of all, that we're having this discussion today in the wake of yet another Seattle Storm playoffs run, despite the fact that 2 high-profile players, Breonna Stewart and Sue Bird, were injured and out for the whole season. Some local reporters, I'm not going to name names, wrote off the Storm this preseason, and yet they endured, and they played a thrilling season and survived their first postseason elimination game before bowing out for the season. And we're also approaching the end of the National Women's Soccer League season with superstar Megan Rapinoe recently making her first start for the Reign post-World Cup win. And last night, if anyone watched, the Reign FC won a really pivotal match against the Utah Royals and are now one step closer to clinching a playoff spot. So this is a really remarkable time, I think, to be following women's sports here in Seattle, and I hope our conversation today can highlight both how far we've come and how much further we have to go, because we still have a long ways to go. I'm not going to eat up too much more of your time before I bring the panelists on, but I wanted to share one quick anecdote. Sadly, here in Seattle, women's sports can still feel a little too much like an underground scene. My wife and I are Seattle Storm season ticket holders, and one Friday night this July, when my sister was visiting, we took her to a Seattle Storm game at the University of Washington, and we rode the light rail to the game. We were surrounded by hundreds of fans and Jordan Canada jerseys and 2018 championship gear, and it felt like, yes, this is our city. Here we all are. It was fittingly inspiring women night at the Storm game, and we played against the Las Vegas Aces and eked out one of these classic Seattle Storm last minute finishes, 69-66, to come the debut. And so, you know, just electrified, buzzing, leaving the arena. We only had 15 minutes to make it across town for our dinner reservation. We hop into a Lyft. The Lyft driver's got a Mariners hat on, longtime Mariners fan. He's like, was there some sort of game happening? It's like, yeah, the Storm won. And he said, who's the Storm? And I had to bite my tongue back from saying, a team that has actually won a championship. Actually, three of them. But, you know, I think we all want to live in a Seattle where people know our women's teams, love our women's teams, admire them, respect them, and go to their games. So I'm hopeful that our conversation tonight can get at some real concrete issues around around women's sports. So without further ado, I want to introduce our first panelist, Jamie Redd, who hails from San Francisco, was a leading scorer and three-time All-Pac-12 player for the Washington Huskies. She went on to play three seasons in the WNBA with the Seattle Storm. Jamie Redd, thank you. And Amy Griffin, who hails from Federal Way, is in her 24th season as an associate head coach for the women's soccer team at the University of Washington. Let's welcome Amy. So Jamie and Amy, chosen because your names rhyme, I'm sure. Both of you are legendary players who have gone on to work as coaches. And I'm interested if you can speak from your own experience comparing the sort of challenges and obstacles that you faced coming up with the challenges that you see young players today face, young women and girls that you coach. Are they still fighting the same battles that you fought?
Absolutely. I think we've progressed and we've come a long way, but I just remember growing up in San Francisco, none of the girls wanted to play sports. So naturally, I spent a lot of my time with the boys at the park playing all the different sports. I was not interested in playing with Barbie dolls. And so for me, it was play with the boys or I didn't have anything to do as far as sports world, because the girls just weren't interested in playing sports back then, which I think it also helped me because, you know, it made me a really good athlete really fast playing with the boys. And then I noticed a shift when I started coaching, just the difference in what the boys team had and what the girls team had. And I felt like as a head coach, I had to fight just for the basics for the young girls, a uniform, to make sure they had shoes. Where the boys had a $15,000 budget, we had $0 in our budget. So just those things still exist, I think, for women's sports. Although we've progressed, we still have ways to go.
Yeah, amen.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the same thing. I think one of the reasons I got into coaching, it was because there was nothing else for me to do, and I wanted to keep playing soccer. So it was the only way I could fuel my passion. There were no pro teams. There was nothing other than the old ladies league after college. So we formed our own leagues, and we paid for our own trips, and we organized our own tournaments from the four regions of the country. So the only other way I could play soccer was to go back to college and play at the highest level. So I just became a coach. So that was it. And then I'm embarrassed that it has taken me so long to realize that I was made to feel that I was supposed to like be so thankful for getting, you know, for being allowed to go to coaching school. I said, thank you so much for letting me in, you know, two of 40 women, you know, or, you know, 38 men, two women. And they said, hey, we really went out on a limb to let you go to coaching school. And so for so many years, I've been like, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. And it's only been really in the last few years, I'm like, well, wait a second here. I deserve that. I should have been. I earned that spot, but I was never made to feel that way. So it is the same thing. I mean, even now, the, you know, what we have to fight for and to have to be so appreciative for everyone else, you know, a lot of the male, our male counterpoints have been getting for a long, long time.
Yeah, yeah. Do your young players now feel like, oh, the sky's the limit for me? Or are there still doubts or fears about, can I go professional? Can I make a career, a life out of sports?
Well, thanks to the women's professional sports and the great role models they have, but I don't think they get to see them often enough. So I still think that what they see, and we talk about exposure a lot. So I have two boys and I don't notice anything different, but when I have friends come to the house, they say, oh my gosh, that's so cool. Your kids don't know the difference between men's and women's sports. They will have one of their friends come over and go, hey, do you want to go to the Husky basketball game? And my youngest will go, is it men's or the women's? And you know, his friend will go, come on, it's the men's. And he's like, well, what do you mean? Kelsey Plum's about ready to score the record, and I want to go to that game. I just wanted to know, is it tonight or tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
And my son, who turns 18 in about 3 days, his number one thing on his birthday list is a Mallory Pugh jersey. So it's exposure. So their exposure in our lives has been the same. So the exposure is kind of an issue. We don't have enough of it.
Yeah, I mean, I love going to Storm games and seeing not just little girls, but also little boys wearing Breonna Stewart jerseys, yeah, or that kind of thing. And speaking of role models, you know, Megan Rapinoe and this last World Cup win, what's it been like for you as part of that 91 team to watch this just electrifying nationwide response to women's soccer?
Jealous. I'm so jealous. Yeah, that's it. It's been really great to be a player and a coach in the eras that I've been able to be a part of, because the change has been drastic, but there's still such a long way to go. So I wished I could have been that brave and that honest and that real much earlier in my life, like Megan Rapinoe's been able to do, and that intelligent and that mindful and just unafraid and courageous. So that's what I think of, as I'm like, man, I missed a lot of opportunity. Not that I was as good or would have had that platform, but there's a lot of little ways that you can say what's going to move this needle further. And I think I just was too embarrassed, or I didn't feel like I deserved it.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about, was this like a really seismic shift for women's soccer? Because, you know, often after a World Cup win, attendance goes up at NWSL games or other women's soccer games, all eyes go on it, and then maybe there's a little bit of a drop-off in attention. Do you feel like something really shifted?
I do. I was lucky enough to be in France for the World Cup, and there was an article in France during the USA-France match, which is a huge match, and everyone was calling that the final. A lot of French fans were in a quandary. They knew the platform that Megan Rapinoe had for equality and for women's rights, and they knew if the USA lost that the platform was much less. And so a lot of the women in France were saying, I want to root for my team, but this is even bigger than the women's national team in France. This is bigger. I have to root for the USA. And there's a great article about that. So yes, yeah, I do feel like there was a shift, and yeah, she is speaking on behalf of the universe, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Jamie, I wanted to ask you, there's a lot of conversation in the WNBA right now about the collective bargaining agreement the players have with the league, pushing for better pay, better travel conditions, other really important aspects of life in the league. And what's your take on those efforts, and how do they compare with what you faced during your time in the W?
I think the young ladies are super blessed right now, because I remember, you know, being one of the trailblazers in the beginning, and thinking, like, you know, our contracts was like $40,000, and then I think the top player was like $60,000. And I think if I go back, I mean, I understand more now that I'm not playing, because everything is driven by revenue, and you got to have people in the stands, you got to have people coming to the games. And Seattle's always been a great place for women's basketball, which is why I chose to go to the University of Washington. And then so naturally when they put the Seattle Storm team here, I knew it would never be a problem having fans because they're loyal here. Whether you lose, whether you win, they're going to ride with you through the storm. And it was weird because one day I remember we were practicing and I can't remember, somebody for the Sonics got hurt. And we were just like appalled. They brought in a replacement player and his contract was $77,000 a day. And I was thinking to myself, like, wait, we make $40,000 for the
year.
I'm confused. Like, what's happening? And so, but I know now, like I said, I think, you know, the league has lasted. No other league has lasted this long as far as women's basketball is concerned. I think they've done well. I think it's time that, you know, the women, that we start bridging that gap and creating more opportunities for women, not only just for their athletic ability, but also for them to be able to do more commercials, to do more stuff like the men. Like, we just have to do a better job of just marketing the women, period.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you were playing salaries in the 40,000s, were you thinking, like, I've got to build this for the next generation? What kept you kind of going through?
I mean, the love of the game. Like, yeah. I mean, growing up, it was like my mindset was college. There was no professional league until, I believe, my sophomore year in college. They had the ABL, and most of, you know, the former Olympians were playing in that league. And then my senior year, that league folded. So everybody left the ABL and then went to the WNBA. And I remember most of those people didn't want to do the WNBA because they were like, oh, you know, that's backed by the men. Like, we don't want to do this. So most people stayed with the ABL. And so I think it's just important to where we're at now that, you know, they have more opportunities for women, that they get the salaries that they deserve, because you're putting a lot of wear and tear on your body.
Yeah.
And your expectations is high. Like, it's like the travel conditions, like, I can't imagine that it's too much different if they're still flying commercial. Like, it's a nightmare. You know, you heard of teams like getting stuck 18-hour trips and then having to get off a plane and come play a game. Like, that just would never happen for the men. But yet you're expected to still do your best, even though you just had an 18-hour trip, 5 layovers, and then you had to take a bus through a snowstorm, and then we want you to play.
Yeah, yeah. I think this season, during the playoffs, they just started doing some charter flights for a couple of teams with really tight schedules, but it's taken this long to get to that point, and the work of the collective bargaining unit.
And I think it's important for your recovery of your body. So, like, if you have to go through the process with everybody else and, you know, flight delays, whereas if you have a charter flight, you know, you can leave earlier, you can leave later, you have time to rest your body. You're not squished up in a seat, you know, with a bunch of other people. So I think it's important.
I wanted to ask you both about the pay issue. You know, folks are often shocked now to hear, like, WNBA salaries better than when you were playing, but not as much as you would want. You know, starting in the, like, 50,000 range, median around 70,000, or the, you know, huge disparity in prize money for U.S. and women's soccer teams playing in the World Cup. What I wanted to ask you both, you know, what does equal pay or fair pay look like in your sports, and how do we get there?
Well, I agree with what Jamie said, is you have to get butts in the seats first, and so everyone's got to support the sports, especially the women's sports. And I would say I haven't seen an accurate matrix that would match what my head wraps around how the women get to be paid what they're deserve, but because I think a lot of it comes down to marketing dollars. So they had the She Believes Cup, and they have the She Believes Cup and the post World Cup tour. And honestly, if you didn't bump into the stadium or you weren't a women's soccer fan getting the email, you wouldn't know there was a game. Versus a friendly of a men's team that didn't qualify for the World Cup. I mean, the mailers I got and the things I saw on TV, even though there was no game in my city, was drastically different. So I think it starts with being seen. And I think if the marketing dollars and the time and the energy is spent promoting the women's athletes, I have to go back to my kids. They don't see any difference in the quality. The best is the best. And the best deserve to get paid. And especially with, like, if I think of U.S. soccer and I think of famous players, I think of Landon Donovan, I think of Clint Dempsey, and then I think of Hope Solo, Megan Rapinoe, Michelle Akers, Alex Morgan. So the U.S. soccer badge to me and a lot of other people, the most famous have been the women. They're driving US soccer right now, believe it or not. And the commercials that I see that are not soccer commercials are the women in the commercials. So I'm not so sure why there's such a big disparity, because in my mind, the best is the best, and they should be paid accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. Jean?
Yeah, I mean, fans in the stands, you know. I think Seattle is very fortunate because, you know, they have Sue Bird, they have Breonna Stewart, you know, players who everybody recognize, you know, UConn grads. I mean, Sue Bird's a pillar in this community. She gets out, she does stuff, and so her face, especially men or women, most men think she's cute, so they're going to come to the game. So it actually helps. The biggest thing, like I said, is you got to have people in those seats. And like I said, I know Seattle has always been a very fortunate organization because we've always led the league in the number of fans in the stands.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a test to, you know, the ownership group willing to, you know, put money into marketing and, you know, to have it visible so that people can see it and young girls can be excited and young boys can be excited about a professional team. And then it also helps because when the Sonics left, there's like the only basketball team here, so people still wanted that experience for their kids.
Yeah.
There's the pro team in the EPL, the English Premier League, the men's side and the women's side of Arsenal, the owners decided to make the pay equal. And because of that, now the stadiums have equal fan base. It happened that quickly. He was like, it makes no sense. I'm the one investing, and I need this to be successful. So in order for me to make this successful, I need to make sure the women have the same as the men.
Yeah.
And now the women are bringing him as much money as the men.
That's amazing.
That's the math.
And that's the end of part one. Stay tuned for more after this message.
In November 1999, members of the World Trade Organization convened in Seattle to negotiate trade agreements for the new millennium. But their talks quickly were overwhelmed by some 40,000 protesters who filled the streets, condemning globalization, corporate power, and the potential impacts of free trade on human rights and the environment.
And we are not afraid!
I'm Knute Berger, Crosscut's editor-at-large. I was in Seattle then. I covered the protests on the streets.
Firing tear gas and spraying pepper spray at us.
I remember what a big deal it was, the so-called battle in Seattle.
The bank window here at US Bank. We gotta get out of here.
The anarchists were a tiny fraction of the thousands who marched on Seattle, but they were a catalyst.
The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching!
Not only a fight for one day or 2 days, the fight for many years.
On November 19th, I'll moderate a conversation with some of the people at the center of the action in 1999. Including John Sellers, co-founder of the Other 98% and board president of the Ruckus Society, and Norm Stamper, Seattle's police chief at the time. Looking back 20 years later, we'll discuss what the battle in Seattle can teach us about who we are, where we've been, and where we're going. Please join us.
For more information about this event, go to crosscut.com/events. Okay, back to the show.
Speaking of owners, we're going to bring our two owners onto the panel, so you two stay put, and we'll keep the conversation going. We're going to have Teresa Predmore come on up. Teresa Predmore is a majority owner of the Reign FC. Please welcome Teresa. And Ginny Gilder is co-owner of The Storm with Force 10 Hoops, the group that purchased The Storm in 2008. Please welcome Ginny. Teresa and Ginny, I wanted to start by asking you both about kind of venue-related challenges of later transitions. Teresa, the Rain moved to Tacoma, to Cheney Stadium, from Memorial Stadium here in Seattle, starting this season. And Ginny, while the arena here in Seattle Center undergoes renovation, the Storm have been playing both at Angel of the Winds Arena up in Everett and Alaska Airlines Arena at UW. And this is an uncommon phenomenon in women's pro leagues, having to find a permanent arena, a permanent place to play, sometimes a challenge. Sometimes renovations mean teams will have to go play on an entirely different side of a city. Walk us through some of these challenges with finding a permanent home and why it's so important to find a really kind of stable long-term home for a women's pro team.
So I think for us, you know, it's, I think for, I'm just going to speak for women's soccer in this one. There are stadiums that are built all around the country and all around the world, and many of them are paid, you know, for by the taxpayers' money. And they're stadiums that are typically being built for men, for men's sports. And it's very rare that you'll see a stadium that's specifically built for women or a women's team. So for us, the challenge was trying to find a place to play. We played at Memorial, which, you know, we loved it, but it was not a great fan experience for the fans. And I think it was that MLS last year did sort of a study on, you know, what makes sort of the numbers, you know, what makes people happy, you know, coming to the games, whatever. And a huge part of it is the fan experience. And when you come into the game, and I think for the girls playing, you know, are you relevant enough? Do you matter enough to have not a second or third tier experience, but the top tier experience? And it was little things for us, like our fans couldn't actually have a beer and watch the game at the same time. And, you know, while I was a little surprised that people didn't want to watch it totally sober, I was also kind of understood. Like, you just want to be able to sit down and have a beer, and you want to have a bathroom that's clean, and it's the whole experience. And I think it is a matter of feeling a little bit like you're just not relevant, like you don't matter, you don't have a place where you can really stay. So for us, when the opportunity opened up in Tacoma, while we were really sad to leave Memorial because it's been a great experience for us as an ownership group and a team, and we had a lot of great memories there, we felt so welcome in Tacoma. The mayor of Tacoma has been so, she's so excitable. It's like, I can't even like stop smiling when I'm around her because she's so excited. And the people of Tacoma are so excited to have a sports team. They don't care if it's a women's or a men's sport team. They're just excited to have a great team there. And it feels really good to us. The Cheney Stadium is an unbelievable experience from both the player perspective and the fans' perspective. You know, it's comfortable, it's great view from everywhere. It's small, it's 7,000, you know, ish seats, so you can be down there seeing the players, and you have great food, the whole thing. It's just a top-notch experience. So I think that, you know, there's sort of a relevance for, you know, do we think it matters for women to have stadiums specifically built for them? And for us, that was, you know, being down in Tacoma, it felt like, you know, it's for the Rainiers, that's what the stadium was built for, but we are the pro team that's there, and we've been so welcome in that city, and I think for us and the fans, it's just been an overall, you know, much better experience.
So before I talk about the Storm, I'm just going to give you some stats because I can't help it. So in 2005, there was a study of all the stadiums, the funding in use by the Big Four, which is considered men's, NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the NHL. There was, from 1990 to 2001, there was a total public subsidy of $17 billion, which is $24 billion in 2018. Dollars, and the average annual subsidy was $1.6 billion for all 99 teams, which is over $16 million per facility. So there is no women's sports team in the United States that has ever been funded to that extent. And in fact, even in the city of Seattle, when we were dealing, when Chris Hansen was negotiating to do an arena, he was going to be granted a $100 million bond. Basically use $100 million of the bond capacity of the city and the county. And so that was viewed as an investment And the Storm went to the mayor, who was Mayor McGinn, and said, you know, you're talking about building a private arena. Where the Storm going to play? And he basically said, we subsidize you. So the language around men's versus women's sports, the way public tax dollars are used, this is a cultural issue. So when we talk about arenas and stadiums, it's just part of that bigger picture. So as for the Storm, we are displaced for 2 to 3 years. We made it through the first, and we're still alive. And we made it, you know, with our coach getting cancer and missing two of our best players. And we're still standing. It was a tough year because... for players, it's not really a home arena when you're driving 30 miles, ninth worst commute in the country. But we're a very resilient team. I think it's kind of emblematic of the city, so we got through it. The one thing that I don't know that people realize is we have a loss share agreement with the city of Seattle that we negotiated when we did a 10-year lease extension with the arena. So they are sharing in our loss to help us deal with the fact that it cost $800,000 to $900,000 to put in air conditioning at Heck Ed. I'm sorry, Alaska Airlines Arena. Yeah. You know, so well, we had to. Those are league rules.
We appreciate it.
Yes, so did our players and fans. those are the kinds of unanticipated expenses that go with a forced transition. Now, look, Key Arena, whatever it's called, is going to be amazing. And we are displaced for the short term. It's going to accrue to our benefit in the long term. NHL Seattle and OVG are building an incredible arena and $930 million of private funding. So you have to look at it in the big picture. It's tough for us, but we're in it with the city and also our fans.
Yeah.
So we'll make it through.
And we've been talking up here about fans in the stands, and we were talking a bit backstage about some of the amazing attendance numbers, for instance, at rain games after the World Cup. What does it take to get more fans in the stands here in Seattle and Tacoma for your teams?
You know, it was really interesting listening to our two kind of, well, first panel speakers talk about the need for marketing. Marketing is something that teams and leagues need to invest in, but before you get marketing, you get media attention. Yeah. And one of the biggest challenges in the United States is the huge disproportionality between the coverage of men's sports and women's sports. Mm. And I couldn't resist because we've been talking about this for a while, and then you invited us. We did a year-long study, 2018, of the Seattle Times coverage of men's and women's sports, and I'd be happy to share stats if you'd
Please
like
do.
To hear it.
Jeannie told me before the panel, I've done all this research.
She's got receipts.
I have receipts. Well, there's one thing about talking about kind of anecdotal experience, but I think we're at a point where we need the hard data, and the hard data is out there, and let's start talking turkey.
Yeah.
So we chose 2018 because it was a very good year for the Storm, and it was, you know, so it was kind of the best you could hope for with a women's team. We did not include the rain specifically. So here we go. Men's coverage, over 85% of all articles and mentions. We did not mention compare inches, column inches. We literally did stories. A story could be one paragraph or a front page mention. And it would have been much worse if we had quantified inches, right? We looked at the Huskies, the men versus the women. Men represent 52% of scholarship athletes at UW. Women get 48% of the financial aid for sports. The UW Huskies men got 2.5 times the coverage of the women Huskies. So now you're not talking about the big four men's pro sports. You're talking about the cultural phenomenon that goes, you know, starts way before college, where men are just considered inherently more interesting and more important. So any professional women's sports team is struggling against that cultural belief. The Seahawks had 5 times as much coverage as the Storm. The Mariners had 3.75 times as much coverage. All other men's sports had 6 times as much coverage as all other women's sports. Men's sports got nearly 12 times as much above the fold coverage as women. So we're talking above the fold of the front page of the sports section. They got nearly 5 times as much below the fold coverage as women. NHL Seattle, which doesn't even have a team. Last year, they already had garnered one-third of the amount of coverage that the Storm had during our championship season. So that is the culture that we are all, and all of our fans, are trying to push against to create space for ourselves. And it's not that I don't think our league has responsibility to take care of our players. We are operating within a certain societal context, and we are part of the opportunity to change it, but we are also, to a certain extent, and I use this word cautiously, victimized by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I want to open that up to the whole panel.
That's a good point, because now that I look back at it, because I remember after that championship run that you guys, the last one that the Storm had, I remember being so mad because the next day I was like, oh, man, this has to be on the news. They won the championship. There was literally no news coverage. I'm like, well, I want to go to the mall and get me a Seattle Storm championship T-shirt. Not one store in the mall had a Seattle Storm championship T-shirt. So those are receipts.
I mean, I want to talk about this kind of big picture cultural question because there's kind of consensus among journalists who cover these leagues, NWSL, WNBA, that the product has never been better, more exciting, more competitive to watch. And when people do come to see it, they often get hooked on it. And yet it's that problem of pushing back against this preconception of, oh, it's just going to be boring to watch. Or
women are slower. Yeah. It's not as fun to watch. That's the thing I hear all the time. And I will say, I had some of my own notes that I'm off the top of my head remembering that I was doing some research that it was 51% of the population are women and 2-3% of the media coverage in sports are women, sports, which is so ridiculously, it's such a huge span of, it doesn't even make sense. But it's not, I do think, like, media is huge. At the Seattle Times, we went and looked, that's our major print paper in Seattle, and we went looking to see, because I remember it was probably 4 years ago, my husband and I were sitting there going like, why? We are putting so much money into marketing, and this is why I like your point. We're dumping everything we have into marketing, and it's not working. It's not sticking. And so he was going insane. So he went to the Seattle Times and looked, and there was maybe 20 sports reporters. One was a woman, and her job was high school sports coverage. And not only just were they all men, they were old white men. And so it was like, and it's like my husband said, I mean, he's like, you know, I am an old white man too. But, you know, these guys grew up watching football. So this is what they think is important to cover. So you need to start getting women in those more powerful positions in the media as well. Like it's not just a sports thing. It's across the board with women. The more you see women in these powerful, influential positions, the more say you have. That one woman whose job it is to cover high school sports is not going to be able to sit at that table and say, I think we need to go cover, you know, the Storm or the Rain today. Yeah. So, and in addition to the media, here's another thing that is still related to media is we've noticed this. We have four kids, one boy and three girls. And video games, when they play sports video games, Xbox or whatever, it's primarily men's sports. So our son is, you know, 10. I think he was like 5. We got an Xbox at home. We have the same thing with Amy. He grew up around the Rain. Since he was 3, that's all he's ever known. He didn't understand that boys played sports. As a matter of fact, he used to say to us, like, oh, I didn't know that the boys played soccer too. So, but now when he plays, there's only really two options. Like, there's the WNBA on Xbox, and then there is some sort of a, you know, women's soccer thing, but it's not as good. He loves to play WNBA. You know, he always chooses to be Sue Bird, and he always fouls her out because she said she would never do it in real life. So, but it's exposure that this is what they're seeing. And when you do have media coverage, if you go and look, we've done so much research, there's so much negative media about female athletes, sexist comments about, I mean, we literally had one comment, I'm sorry, there's a little girl in the room here, but the comment right under this woman winning this award was, maybe the bitch should get back in the kitchen. This is the first comment under, we have a Sports Illustrated writer on Twitter saying, it's not just women's soccer, it's women's sports in general that aren't worth it. And he's like a high profile, so it's negative media coverage in addition to no media coverage. It's just not a great you know, it's not a great combination right now.
Yeah. The WNBA just got added to the video game NBA 2K2020, yeah. I think. And I was so excited. And of course, I read the comments to the article, right? It was just atrocious. Yeah. But, you know, on this topic of media, I wanted to ask you about, you know, broadcasting agreements and how important those are. I know ESPN and NWSL announced a broadcasting deal earlier this year, kind of in the middle of World Cup fervor. And CBS Sports is airing, I think, 40 more live games this past season. How important are these broadcasting agreements, and how much further do they have to go, frankly, to get more eyeballs?
They're really important. When you think about the number one source of revenue for these salaries for men's pro teams, it's all because of the contracts they have. So it's absolutely critical that any women's pro league gets contracts and gets good contracts. The challenge is that broadcasters use a kind of circular reasoning. There's not enough interest, so advertisers don't want this. There's not enough eyeballs, so we aren't going to pay you or pay you enough to really justify it from the revenue perspective. And of course, it takes you back to this, you could call it a triad of the relationship between sports media and advertising. And none of us is really old enough to remember that TV sets needed to be sold when TVs first came on the market, and that was when sports coverage started. So they did it for an economic reason. And when sports coverage, when there was a period when 1980 to 84, the NFL lost 7% of their viewers, and Major League Baseball lost 26% of their viewers. Do you know what they did? They increased the number of games. Do you know? And that's exactly what they should have done to build the audience. But if that happened with the WNBA, for 5 minutes, your eyeballs went down. Sorry, you guys are out. That's literally how women's sports are treated. There is no long-term perspective in terms of this is important. We need to invest and stay the course to help this grow, help grow this part of our offering. There's no commitment. So I just think this is a critical issue, and it's what our women's professional sports leagues are really about is equity, diversity, and inclusion. That's what we're about. That's what our fans love about us. It's also, frankly, I think corporate sponsors are going to start getting this before the broadcasters, because this is such an important issue in mainstream America, and employees want to be affiliated with a company that mirrors their own values. So it change is coming. It might not come from the broadcasters, but it's all connected.
Yeah, yeah. Any other thoughts on that point?
What she said.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to ask, you know, I wanted to kind of turn the conversation toward those kind of solutions, like what can broadcasters do? What can arenas do? What can fans do? What could people in this room do to help women's teams and women's pro leagues and women's sports?
I think that broadcasting has improved, but I did a little commentating, and it was the play-by-play guy was always the guy that had to do the women's game and didn't know their names and didn't know the sport and didn't know the intricacies between. That was what made the women's game great. So I think even now you'll watch a women's game and they'll talk about what the women had for breakfast and how great it was that they saw them strolling their kids around while the game is tied in the waning minutes. I'm not even kidding you. So the fact that you can tell they don't legitimize the fact that there's a quality game going on and their product, I feel like a lot of the broadcaster's product needs to. They need to bring their A game for the women, and I think sometimes it's you get to do this and you get your free trip to wherever the Olympics are or whatever. And so I think that's a big part of it is for women's soccer. JP Della Camera is probably one of the best, and he was one of the ones I did work with. That he loved doing the women's game, and I mean to the point where he was like, you know, we can't ride in the same elevator because what if the elevator gets stuck? Then there won't be anybody there at the game, and I was asking him how to put makeup on because I didn't, and he did. But so I think the stories that you tell, the game is going to grow 100% by the stories you tell and how they're told, and to bring to highlight the best, to highlight what is great about the women's sports, what is great about the women's athletes. And right now, it's not there yet. I think we have a ways to go.
Are we starting to see more? I've noticed all of these profiles of Megan Rapinoe. There's an outlet called The Athletic that's been doing a lot of amazing interviews with women athletes. Are we getting there, or is it just progress by degrees?
Like, I mean, you can't speed up Mother Nature.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of it, but
Megan's doing a pretty good job.
She is. She is.
Oh, yes, you can.
Yeah. Megan this year has. I mean, she was in. This is actually another example of media coverage. She was in Milan receiving an award on Monday. It was Monday morning for us, Monday night. The FIFA, you know, best player in the world award, basically, she wins. And my husband and I instantly went on the Seattle Times Twitter page because, you know, that's where everyone gets their news now. And there was no mention. So we tweeted it. We tweeted it at them. No retweet, no mention. And I counted, there were 28 football tweets that happened, and it was 12 hours later that they finally retweeted what we had. And I thought, she's the best in the world, and she's right here in Seattle. So, you know, she's making a huge impact all over the world right now. And I feel like she is not just changing it for women's soccer. She's changing it for women right now. And we've had emails from this woman in Rwanda who found someone to send an email saying, like, I literally can't even watch TV, but I listen to everything Megan Rapinoe says, and she gives me hope. And that's not just one email. We've had a lot of those. So she's making a massive impact around the world right now. So, you know, that I do feel like there's a shift after the World Cup this year. And it isn't just for women's soccer. I think it's for women in general. That covers all women's sports, all, you know, all different areas of life. But, you know, I think we all look at it, it's so much better than when we played, but it's nowhere near where it needs to be at this point. And it's been under, this is the equal pay thing that's hard for me, is it's been severely underfunded for so many years that it isn't going to just be like, well, let's catch them up. I mean, you are going to have to put some serious funding in to get it to be equal. And I think that's a huge miss right now, that people aren't really understanding the amount of funding that has to go into that.
Yeah, I think Sue Bird had an Instagram post today about, like, we as players understand the revenue needs to go up in these leagues, but what we have right now is like an investment gap as well in the teams and the leagues.
And that's all women's sports.
Yeah.
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about backstage, and I want to bring this conversation out here about how people can sometimes compare the state of women's sports to the big men's leagues. And there's this sort of recency bias of assuming, like, oh, the NBA has always been dominant. It's always been in great shape when, as we know, if you were alive long enough or studied up in your sports history, the NBA really struggled in the late 70s and early 80s and had to get television agreements to really, and huge investment to really grow the league to where it is today. How do you deal with kind of being compared to, say, a men's pro league that's much older, much more established, and has had more investment?
Oh, I think it's pretty easy. You, frankly, you just lay it out. You look at the extent of implicit and explicit bias against women throughout our culture, and this is just one more very vivid example. And it's not like this is the only place. So, and you provide the statistics. It's when we bought the Storm 12 years ago, I actually did go back, and I kind of did a little spreadsheet on the NBA's growth and because the league just is finishing its 23rd year, so I came in around year 11 or 12, and there was a lot of consternation then in the press about, was the league going to survive? I mean, I think that finally died out about 4 or 5 years ago, but every year predictions were the league was going to die. And I went back and traced the number of teams in the NBA's first 10 to 15, 20 years of how many teams folded, how many teams moved. It was exactly the same. And I was like, oh, this is just part of a league establishing itself. But people piled on with the fact that this was a new league with, oh, this is women, and who cares about women? And that's just kind of, you can look at the comment section of any article about any women's sports team, and you're going to see that stuff. You're going to see stuff that, like, if I didn't, like, I'm not a big hockey fan, right? But I am not going to go online and write a trash talking, you know, comment about a team I'm not interested in. Just, like, move on. So I don't really understand that. But yeah. It is, I actually think it shows the extent to which the extension of women into something that has been very traditionally kind of a male bastion threatens a certain amount of men. And this is, before the 2016 election, I thought, oh, this is the last gasp. Now I'm not so sure. But there is a segment of our country that does not really believe in the reality that women can do the same kind of thing that men do and deserve to have the opportunity to pursue their dreams, whether they're athletic, scientific, political, although God help them, that should be their right.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Well, and I think they're, like, if you just take the, you know, the bias out of it and you don't talk about whatever men and women, as business owners, it makes me feel a lot better. Like, I start to get like, oh my God, what, you're in it day to day and you get frustrated. And then we'll talk to like Adrian Hanauer of the Sounders, who we talk to frequently, and he's super helpful. Like, okay, we went through this ourselves in the MLS, and the MLS went through this. And if you take all of that, I mean, that's all definitely true. But if you're just looking at businesses, it's a new business still for us. You know, we've been doing this for 7 years, and the NBA is way older than the MLS with that. But for us, it's just kind of recent enough to go, oh, they went through these struggles too. And it didn't matter if they were men or women. So it gives me hope that you're just a new business. You're starting off and you have all these things you're trying to work through. You can pull through it the same if you can get past the bias part. Yeah. So, I mean, you can kind of separate those two, because it's easy to get bogged down with the sexism part of it. One thing I have found in conversations, I had to go talk to a panel of coaches for the academies, and I walked into the room and the woman said to me, there was 22 men and 2 women in the room. And she said, oh, can you please cover sexism? Because I may have said some stuff last night that really pissed him off. And I was literally walking up to the front of the room. And I mean, I could tell they were not happy with the whole thing. And as I talked and we worked through it, I had read the Melinda Gates book this summer, The Moment of Lift. And one of the things she said in there that I thought was really amazing was that women are not trying to replace men at the top of the hierarchy. What they want to do is work together with the men to break down the hierarchy altogether. And the minute I realized that, and the minute I said that to the men in the room, they just softened a little bit. They were a little bit less, you know, no one is going to respond well, like, hey, you're sexist and you're starting to really piss me off, but could you give me a couple $1 billion for my team? Like, it's just not going to work that way. And we are mad and it is frustrating and we have every right to be mad. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to move forward to break this down? What are the steps we have? And the research is, I think, super important. The numbers matter. The anecdote, like, that's great, all these stories, but the numbers and looking at the history of it and looking at the history of when the men's teams were young like that, I think it gives everybody just a little bit of hope that we can move forward this way. And it does have to move forward in, like, what can we do? Concrete steps instead of just being angry about it. And I think we can still be angry, but moving forward with that, what can we do? And that was kind of the question I think you started with.
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted to bring back this piece when we were talking a little earlier about just like how tremendously outspoken the kind of platforms that the female athletes have to in the values of diversity and inclusion. I think we're at a really exciting moment where people are recognizing, like, sports is political. Like, you can't disentangle those things. And I think a lot of people come to WNBA games because those values of diversity, inclusion align with them. Same with rain games. Do you feel like the women are kind of leading the way on that right now?
I mean, I'm probably not the person to ask because I've always been outspoken.
Yeah.
So I've never really held my tongue. So I've always been straightforward. I've always been super honest, and I am that one that will always bring up the hard conversations, the elephants in the room. So, but I do think it's exciting that women are speaking, because some little girl is somewhere out there is looking to be something, and they see your voice and your platform, and they now have hope that they can go try, do, and be whatever that may be.
Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, I would say this, the same thing, and then, you know, when you were saying everyone should and deserves to have equal opportunity to be whoever they are, I think even now in my 24 years at UW, we've had, you know, a male sports information director that shares his time with two other male sports. So if there's a road trip to go on, he's going to go on the men, you know. Or our fundraising department, same thing. We share a person, and they're, if they have to make a choice, they go and they raise money for the men's Olympic sports. So it's a matter of having, like you say, having the equality be that everyone is doing the same for everyone and just doing their best, and having a lot more women being able to speak on behalf of us, you know, instead of us. We've been second tier for so long that it's great that we have the microphone, and sometimes I get a little bit hurt because it's cool now it's the hip thing. I'm like, wait, where were you're doing it now because you know you can raise money, but where were you? And then I'm like, wait, I shouldn't be saying that, you are doing it now.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a catch-22, but yeah, I think the shift is happening, and it's our job to push it.
It's been really interesting for me to watch my friends, most of them kind of millennial women. A lot of them recently have come to become sports fans because they've seen Megan Rapinoe or they've seen Sue Bird, and they're like, oh, I like their politics, I like their style, I like everything about them. Hey, don't they also like play in my hometown? I could go see them do some amazing athletic feats while I'm at it.
I think we live in a really unique and awesome region for women, and there are a lot of us that had the opportunity to play on the women's national team that came from the Washington area, and we didn't really realize it. We were talking about our youth growing up, and I don't, you know, I feel like I didn't have as much opportunity as the guys, but I had way more opportunity than a lot of other girls in a lot of other parts of the country. And this Northwest region really has driven a lot of what's great about the movement that's happening and the people in this area. And I think I'm extremely fortunate to grow up where I did, because I wouldn't have had all of the opportunity living somewhere else.
Teresa, have you seen that with Rain Academy? Just
Yeah, I mean, well, so Amy is also the head of our Rain Academy.
Oh.
So we made the, we got really lucky with that one. We made the decision to start an academy. Like, when we were doing the Rain, we thought, like, we really need to hit the youth at the same time with this. So we started the academy, and it's now the only all-girls academy in the area. And it's run by women. It's Amy and myself, and, well, Bill helps too, but another woman named Annie. We all sort of run it, and then we have, you know, a lot of male and female coaches. We've got both, but it's primarily run by women. And so we realized the value of having these girls, you know, and they've got exposure to the Rain players, which is a really unique opportunity for them. And so I think these kids, it's slow. I mean, it's happening, but it's changing. And these girls, you know, even our own kids, they're so much more empowered than we were as kids. My daughters are ridiculous. They make me feel so old with the things. Like, I'll say something, they're like, oh my God, you're so, you know, whatever, such an old lady. They're so empowered already, and they don't stand for stuff that we stood for when we were little, because they're watching us go, they're watching us wake up and go, oh, wait a minute, that is not okay to do that. That was never okay. And I think having all these role models and all these women to look at, and particularly the female athletes, there's just sort of a worship for them, you know, and this desire to, I feel like the women are so strong when they speak, and they just bring such an amazing message that it is really, to me, it's going to be impossible for these little girls not to grow up and have that now. And we just didn't really have that growing up.
Can you talk a bit about why that age is so critical? I know there are all sorts of statistics about, you know, the age at which girls start dropping out of sports at higher rates than boys.
Yeah, I don't know.
Boys.
Do you have information on that part of it? I think middle school is really a time when they start to, you see a huge decline for the girls. I think it's really, I grew up playing in clubs around here. I've watched a lot of the clubs. They are all run by men, all of them. And
they are very much threatened by the Rain Academy being run all by all women. And there has been, without getting into too much detail, some really horrific sort of backlash. Like, we're not fan favorites in the city with the Academy, with people. I mean, the other clubs are really not happy with us coming in and doing. We're trying to change it, and they don't like that. It's different. So I think it's really powerful with these girls to just... It's not like we put this club out here and said the boys are... I watched coaches. Like, we have talked to coaches who said, I've been out there, women coaches, I've been out there for 3 or 4 years, and I'm still coaching the D level. And, oh, by the way, one of our coaches, she's been coaching for like 40 years. She has every license you could imagine. She coached me. She coached everyone I know, and she was in a club coaching at the C level and never got the opportunity to move up. And so for us, we want those female coaches for the girls. We want that female camaraderie. There's a lot of power when you get a group of women together. And it's not to say that men don't have that with themselves, but women are just starting to do this in a way that's like, oh my God, it feels so good to get together and have this power. And I see it with the little girls as well. And having a girl coach, I mean, it shouldn't be that unusual to have a girl coach, but it really is.
So
I feel like the Academy is huge.
Yeah, I think you touched on a very important point with the coaching of, you know, the gender roles, because when you look at, you know, just sports in general, most of us have had male coaches. Like, you don't see female coaches, and I think it's very important, because then you get that mentorship, you get someone who understands. You know, sometimes the men have incredible standards that, like, you're like, okay, a girl can't do that. Like, I train, and some of the stuff they have the girls doing, I'm just like, okay, so she's going to be sitting on the bench, she's never ever going to play, because you have her step back, shooting a three, crossover, fall on the floor, jump back up and shoot her. It's just not going to happen, right? And so, like, even I go back to UW, like, I was fortunate because back then, like, we had one of the only female athletic directors in a Power Five conference. Like, how many women are athletic directors at major universities at that time? And then to fast forward to now, to have somebody who I watched start at the very bottom, and, you know, gratefully from UW, is now the AD at UW, you know? So I think it's important for them to see us. Like, no offense to any man, but, like, until recently, we couldn't go to the other side. You didn't see a woman in the NBA coaching. It wasn't going to happen. You didn't see a woman on the coach's side for college basketball. So, but now those doors are starting to open, because they're like, huh, like, we want the best talent that is there. It doesn't have to be by gender.
Yeah. We're going to take audience questions in a minute. But before we do, I wanted to kind of bring the conversation back to the question of, what can folks in this room do? What are concrete steps that someone could come away from today? What could someone take away and say, I'm going to do this to support my teams?
So I think I'm always thinking both kind of, what can you do from a concrete perspective, and then in terms of your own thinking. And I totally agree with what Teresa said. You know, you can't pound people into the ground and say, you guy there. You know, it doesn't work. But I think each of us in this day and age in the United States has an opportunity to start thinking about, have I bought into the myth that masquerades as fact that men are inherently more interesting athletically to watch than women or girls? And, you know, my daughter played Division I soccer. She's, thank goodness, through that. But I was... You know, I watched her from age 5 all the way through college. And, you know, last I checked, boys and girls still have the same number of parents, you know, same number of family friends, same number of relatives. And by the time she was 10 years old, there was a gap between the number of folks who were watching her games. We're talking middle school, where girls are still pretty much on par with boys. There were fewer people watching her games than the boys' games. By high school, it's severely pronounced. And by college, she was on a Division I team, and the men's soccer team at her school was an intramural sport, and they had more fan engagement than her team did. This is a cultural issue. So what can we do? We can start thinking about our own behavior, our own attitudes, in the privacy of our own heads. You know, we don't have to shame ourselves. This isn't about shaming ourselves. This is about thinking about, what kind of world do I want to live in? What kind of community do I want to be part of? Do I want my daughter, my niece, my sister, okay, maybe sisters, you know, my sister's 57, but you get the idea. Do I want them to have the same opportunities as my son, my nephews, et cetera? And then how am I spending my entertainment dollars? You know, what are the decisions that I'm making? What am I expecting from my companies in terms of, do they have Mariner tickets, Seahawk tickets? Well, what about the rain? What about a box at the Storm? I mean, these things that are done unconsciously by companies. And, you know, it's funny. I'm not really angry. I'm not bitter about the way things are. Hell, I've been an owner for 12 years, and all I'm interested in is, you know, busting down doors and changing this world to look the way I think it should look. And being a Storm owner, WNBA, Seattle Storm, we live at the intersection of sports, business, and social change. There's nowhere else I would want to be. But that is about, you know, finding our partners, our fans, our corporate sponsors, and also people in the media who want to link arms and change the world. And Seattle is a great place for that, and there are a lot of opportunities to support girls and women in a myriad of ways, not just on the field of sports, but that's certainly a good place to start.
Yeah.
I think we're lucky in Seattle, too, that we, you know, just to kind of piggyback on that, we've been able to find the men in this city that really care the way we do, and they want to lift it up too. Like, we're doing it together in a lot of ways. And I do think, like, finding people who want to work with you on it, men, women, as long as you're like-minded and you care, and we all want to be conscious of all of this. Like, what do I want my kids to grow up in? What do I want kids to see on TV? And, you know, whatever, you take your family to the Storm game, you take your family to the rain game. It just seems like it's very automatic to go to any of the men sporting events at this point, but to consciously just say, or tell your friends, or, you know, I noticed a lot of stuff is like at auctions I'm going to now, I'm seeing all this Storm and rain stuff and people bidding huge amounts to get to it, which I never saw before. So it's those little things. And I do think when you're at work, you know, and you're, hey, you guys want to go to this game with us, bring your kids, we'll go, whatever, or your group of friends. I think it's exposure, exposure, exposure. And I think it just becomes a lot more, you know, normal for people to see women playing sports and for people to get excited about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just beat a dead horse. From every single level, get butts in the seats, which drives revenue, which drives interest, which drives media, which drives hiring, all of that. But if you want to start at the very bottom, I think you have to show up.
Yeah.
You have to show up.
I've become a Storm evangelist this past season.
Nice.
Our family comes to visit every summer, and so every game we're like, okay, who's coming with us to this game? Who's coming to the next game?
But, you know, the other thing we can do now is you can tweet at the Seattle Times. You can tweet at ESPN. Yeah. You can say, are you kidding? Did you not see that amazing goal by Pino? Why is that not on SportsCenter's top 10? Like, you can start doing that. I mean, we have that opportunity to engage now and take advantage of it.
And that works. They often feel like, oh, God, we missed that, you know, and then they maybe don't miss it the next time. So.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so, so much. We're going to get to audience questions now, if that's okay. So these have been collected from folks who have submitted it through some high-tech means to this iPad here, and I'm going to ask you some of the more popular ones. This is an interesting question. Do you think the rise of the Me Too movement has helped raise awareness of issues around women's sports?
Yeah, this is an amazing time for all of this stuff to be talked about. I think when women get up like Megan Rapinoe and talk, she's not really talking about soccer. I mean, she's talking about women and the thing, and actually not even just women, but anyone who's in a position where they have been underserved. I think that's who she is speaking on behalf of. So I think it's huge, and I think it's a lot of people are waking up right now. A lot of people were already awake. A lot of people might take longer, but I think it's such an important time right now for everyone to not, like, you got to get on board right now. This is the time to do it.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Yeah, you have people like Stewie, right? Breonna Stewart, who came out in the media about her own story of abuse. And so then you have the use of sports as a platform. So it kind of ends up to talk about violence against women. So you're both using the platform of sports to promote the value set of really what the Me Too movement is about. And which is awesome. And then you're also highlighting the power of sport and the power of athletes who really are celebrities, you know, and even our women, right? I mean, these are, I mean, Sue, Megan, I mean, they are much more popular, well-known than many, many male sports athletes. And they are figuring out the power of that sports platform. And it really kind of augments the value of sports, I mean, in a weird cyclical way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was such a powerful moment. And it brought so much attention to the league, to the team. Here's another question that's related to kind of broadcasting issues. As a Storm season ticket holder, we would love to watch the away games on TV. What will it take to make that possible?
Well, what I would say is there's always live access. So every single Storm, every single league game is available on like live access. Yeah, you have to pay, but hey, the only way we pay our players is if our fans actually pay for the product. So think of it that way. And that's really what my response would be.
Yeah, yeah. This is a list of specific things fans can do: buy tickets, buy merchandise, write your newspaper, contact ESPN and other networks, click on stories about your teams and read them.
Yeah, social media is really huge. That's a great platform for getting messages across. I think like what you said is it is sort of a good place to call someone out to be. It is outrageous that you're not putting the fact that Megan Rapinoe just won this award, like in the day of the internet and Twitter, it shouldn't take you 12 hours to announce that. It should take you 5 minutes to announce it, especially when it was tweeted at you. So it just shows what you value, yeah, you know, and what you think is relevant right yeah. now.
This is a question for the soccer folks. How is the U.S. Soccer Federation funded? Is it strictly based upon gate receipts and advertising revenue? Is any federal funding involved?
From how I understand it, there's not federal funding, but a lot of the youth players are paying for U.S. soccer, and it is a little bit coming from the ground up, and a lot of it is sponsorship dollars as well. But the pay-to-play, the club environment has become more and more expensive, and part of that falls on the heels of U.S. soccer, but at the same time, now that soccer has become a much more major sport than it was when I was a kid, the sponsorship dollars have also increased exorbitantly.
Yeah.
I
don't know more
about that. No, that's basically the answer.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the thing about the United States Olympic teams. There are no federal tax dollars support any national governing body for Olympic sports. It's very different from every other country or from many other countries.
Yeah.
It's not just about soccer or basketball. It's across every sport.
Be a good time to think outside the box. I know, I believe it's Norway. In Norway, there was a Bryant Gumbel special. All the gambling dollars pays for youth sports. So youth sports up to U12 is free. And then if you're good enough to go to some of the academy or national programs, then it's still free. And then you pay a small sum if you're 14 or over to play in the rec leagues. But like I said, it's become more and more expensive, and so you're eliminating a lot of kids that need an opportunity. It's another huge issue for a different podcast, maybe.
Here's a question related to, you know, the fact that we can watch many of these women who play on the Rain and the Storm play internationally, play on amazing national teams. So one way to get butts in seats, Anonymous says, is for players to be marketed in the off season. How can the U.S. leagues promote them when they're playing overseas?
I know back in the day that was like the blueprint for the WNBA, is that those who did not choose to go overseas and make four times the amount of money that they were making here would stay in the community, would do camps, clinics, speak at schools. So I know that they did that. I mean, they've kind of gotten away from that a little bit. I haven't seen it as much because I know it's one of the things we talked about as former players, just not having their face out more. But I get it because, you know, are you going to stay here? Because at the point we were getting $250 for each appearance that we did, or are you going to go overseas and you're going to make $300,000 for 6 months?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and for our players, I mean, their season is short here. They have to go play somewhere, so they're down in Australia playing. It's really hard to promote people who are in Australia here in Seattle. I mean, you can work with, you know, we've worked with different leagues to try to, you know, share resources to do that, but these players have to go make money. They're not making enough money to live off of by just playing in this league.
Yeah. We've dealt with a lot of kind of chicken and the egg questions. Here's another one. Does the coverage come with funding, or does the funding come with coverage? How do we produce one without the other?
Well, I think it depends on what you think the role of major corporations in America are. And I think this is one of the questions that the W is tackling, certainly with our new commissioner, which is, are you going to wait for the culture to shift, or are you going to be part of the change? And I think there are a lot of companies across the country that want to be part of the change, that recognize the value of diversity, that recognize that actually women-led teams can often perform better. And so there's an economic value to investing in sponsorship, affiliating yourself with women's pro sports teams. But to change something, a culture that's so, I mean, we've seen this. It's not like this is the first time the United States has had to shift its culture. We were a country that owned slaves, right? We've shifted. I mean, it's not perfect. Women didn't have the vote. So this is just another cultural shift that we have to generate. How did those happen? They started with individuals who deeply believed that the way we did stuff was wrong. And then slowly, you know, the odds of change started at zero, right?
Yeah.
And slowly things shifted and the tide shifted. And that's where each one of us actually gets to throw our voice in the ring and try to make change.
Yeah. I mean, I think we know from social science research that when women are in leadership positions, whole organizations change. And here's a question related to that for our owners. When we look at ownership in women's sports, how do we get more women involved in decision-making?
In decision-making, do you mean as owners or in leagues?
We would have to ask anonymous, but I assume just in maybe in positions of leadership or maybe more women owning teams.
Well, so in the WNBA, we've had a woman president or commissioner the league's entire life, which I think is really important. The 12 years that I've been there, there are only two. There used to be three, but there's two all women-owned franchises. There's no question that you kind of got to see it to believe it. So I think there are girls and women out there who know that women are parts of ownership groups of franchises, and so it's something that you can aspire to. Although I can tell you that in 2007, I had no idea I was going to own a sports team. I'm not exactly sure how it happened. So the other thing that's happened, and is in our franchise, we are CEO, GM is a woman. We hire the best candidate, which is often a woman, often a guy. I mean, whoever we hire. And so we have created our own, you know, path, if you will, to engagement at all levels of a sports franchise, and that's the, you know, we're creating a pipeline because we need really good people. And frankly, there are a lot of women who want to work in women's pro sports. So, and there's some guys too. And so that's who we hire. And so it's just the fact of our existence as a league, it engenders interest and it starts to develop a pathway for more leadership.
Yeah. Teresa, do you have thoughts?
Well, I just think you're going to see with this whole change right now, and, you know, I read a lot of stuff through, like, you know, female leaders. I think there was just a list. Was it Forbes list of top CEOs that just came out? Was that? It was one woman on the list. This was I think women, it's shockingly further behind than I thought it would be. It's not just in sports, and it's not just in sports ownership. It's just in women in those influential, powerful positions in general. You need to see those people to know, like you said, to know it can happen, to know. And I know with the NWSL, we're further behind than you are with the women. I mean, it's all male owners, you know, besides me with, you know, partnered with my husband in there. almost all male coaches. Like the roles of the people in power are men still. And you have to change it through things like, okay, in our youth academy, we're going to have all women running it. And hopefully when these women are moving up, they're going to be stepping up into roles where, you know, they can do this. But I think it's just a change that's, it's slow, but I do think as you start to see these women in these powerful positions, you can see it and dream it for yourself.
Yeah. And speaking of big dreams, I saved the biggest, most overarching question for the very end. I'd love to hear from everyone before we close off. Anonymous asks, do you think equal pay will ever happen?
Yes, I do. I think it will be slow, but I do think it will happen.
So I have a contrarian view to this. I actually, my dream is that the WNBA becomes as popular as men's pro sports, but we recreate how compensation for athletes is done, because you heard the stats on how much public subsidy goes to sports, and my dream is that you actually would create a three-way revenue share between owners, players, and the local community. So maybe players wouldn't make as much, but that whole community would benefit in a new way.
Yeah.
What she said.
Yeah.
Amy?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I do. I don't think if it had started off equal, no one would be having this conversation. And that's where it went wrong, right?
Yeah.
It was way back when. So it wouldn't seem that extraordinary or remarkable if it started off as it should have been.
Agreed. It's been such a pleasure to have you. Let's say give a big warm round of applause for our panelists.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Rusty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.